dominated by gears and valves and intestinal-looking tubes that crawled over the walls and ceiling to converge on the roof of a box in the corner. It was about the size and shape of a telephone booth, but it was windowless, forbidding, and cast from iron.
"I wanted you to see firsthand what was done,"
Sharon said, gesturing to the box. It was, of course, the battery chamber. The huge lock that had secured its door lay smashed on the floor. Sharon opened the door. The inside was empty. The leather straps were stretched out and worn ragged from the hollow's long struggle against them, and the chamber's interior walls were stained and splattered black with a residue only I could see, the hollow's tears.
"Your little friend is gone," Sharon said.
"He wasn't my friend," I said, surprised at the sudden wave of guilt I was feeling. Hologast were monsters, but they could feel pain and fear, and I remembered vividly the howls it made after it was strapped in and the chamber door closed.
"Regardless," Sharon said, "he is gone, and we have no more. Travel is impossible. Operations here have ground to a halt."
"And what do you want me to do about it?"
"I don't suppose," said a high voice from behind us, "you could get us another one."
We turned to see a dour woman hunched in the doorway, dressed all in black. She had a strange growth between her eyes.
"Miss Blackbird,"
Ulysses said, and bowed smartly. I couldn't quite believe my ears.
"You want me to get another one?"
She forced her dour expression into a smile.
"If it isn't too much trouble."
"I'm sorry," I said, struggling for words. "I don't know where I'd find one."
"Oh."
Her smile collapsed.
"Too bad."
Emma stepped in front of me.
"Miss Blackbird, with all due respect, Jacob nearly lost his life getting the one you had. It isn't fair to ask him..."
She waved her hand.
"No, no, you're absolutely right. It isn't fair. Now,"
she pinned Emma with a sharp look,
"who precisely are you?"
Emma straightened.
"Emma Bloom."
She nodded quickly.
"Of course, yes. Alma Peregrine's brood."
Her eyes traveled quickly over my friends.
"I've heard you're feisty. And you must be La Lumiere,"
she said, turning to Noor, then blinking as if she couldn't properly see her.
"Eyes bothering you, miss?"
asked Ulysses.
"Yes, I'm afraid so. They're next to useless some days, but I can still depend on number three. Wake up, lazy bones!"
She tapped the growth on her forehead, and it split open to reveal a large, red-rimmed eyeball.
"What's that?"
Bronwyn said, then looked mortified at her own rudeness.
"My third eye, and lucky for me, he's still sharp as a tack."
Her two milky eyes were staring straight at Noor, but the big one in the center of her head was looking at me.
"Anyhow, not to worry about the hologast," she said. "They're a pain to deal with, and the cleanup is frightful. We do have a backup in the works. We suspected the hologast battery wouldn't last forever, so we've spent these past few months developing an alternative."
All three of her eyes now gazed expectantly at Sharon.
"Maybe a little while before we can bring it into operation, madam," Sharon said. "It isn't quite ready yet."
"A few days at most,"
Miss Blackbird said, her voice and smile cracking with stress.
"Come, Portman, there's something else I want to discuss with you."
She looked at my friends.
"Alone."
As we climbed the stairs to the Panlupticon's first floor, Miss Blackbird talked at me fast and close in a Scottish lilt that was sometimes hard to decipher. She briefed me on what had happened, most of which I'd already heard from Millard, while keeping one claw-like hand on my arm always, like she was afraid I might run away if she let go. When we reached the second landing, the bitter stink of burned carpet hit my nose. Halfway down the hall, I could see where the bomb had gone off. The walls and floor were blackened, and a half dozen loop doors had been splintered and blown off their hinges. Another Imbrin was conferring with a girl in a black suit and matching apron, Ulysses's same outfit, a uniform for temporal affairs people, and various adults were buzzing around the still-smoking blast zone, collecting bits of debris in bags and taking measurements. It was, after all, a crime scene.
"I didn't really expect you to go off and capture us another hologast, Portman. That was just a bit of fun, eh?"
She smiled apologetically, as if imploring me not to share her bizarre request with Miss Peregrine. "Sure," I said, and smiled back. "I won't tell."
"One moment," she said,
and she went to speak with the other Imbrin, a tall black lady in a wide-collared blazer and knit tie, and I pretended not to notice them glancing at me while they talked. Instead, I turned to study the loop door next to me, which was hanging crooked in its frame. Its brass nameplate was scratched, but still readable. Yasser Volcano, Island of Tana, New Hebrides, January 1799. Curious, I nudged the door with my foot. It swung open to reveal the usual bedroom common to most Panlupticon gateways. Three walls, a floor, a ceiling. But the missing fourth wall did not, as promised by the plaque, lead to a vista of some tropical island volcano. It was simply blank.
"Sorry to keep you waiting,"
Miss Blackbird returned with the other Imbrin in tow.
"This is Miss Baybax, my co-chair of temporal affairs."
Miss Baybax's face widened into an ethereal smile, and she extended her hand to shake mine.
"Such a pleasure to meet you, Jacob," she said in a smooth English accent. "We sent for you this morning because you might be our best hope."
Her gaze was intense and unwavering. I felt a tightness grow in my chest, the same one I got any time people expected big things from me.
"We don't know what these whites aim to do," said Miss Blackbird, "but we need to recapture them before they hurt anyone else."
Her third eye blinked rapidly.
"We've already lost one peculiar child," Miss Baybax said. "It ends there."
"I'm with you," I said. "How can I help?"
"We know they have a hologast with them," Miss Blackbird said. "That makes him more dangerous. But it also..."
Her head tilted and she raised her thick eyebrows. "Makes them trackable," I said. "By me." She smiled.
"Precisely." "Your talents could prove invaluable here," said Miss Baybax.
"I'm happy to help any way I can."
"Don't say yes just like that,"
Miss Baybax said sharply, holding up a finger.
"I want you to know what you're getting into."
Miss Blackbird frowned. Miss Baybax went on.
"These aren't just any whites. They were the worst we had. Dangerous, devious, and depraved. Have you heard of Percival Murnau?"
"Call's lieutenant," I said.
"That's right," said Miss Baybax. "He and his three butchers. They alone are responsible for at least half the destruction and mayhem the whites have visited upon us in recent years. If we were to read a list of their crimes, it would make your hair curl," said Miss Blackbird.
"I'm sure they're awful," I said, "but I've faced worse." That tightness in my chest began to dissipate. Sometimes I forgot myself and what I had already done and accomplished.
"Call himself," Miss Blackbird said with a touch of awe, "and the whole army of his whites."
She winked at me.
"Which is the only reason I asked about you know what. But then Mr. Portman had an army of hologast under his command to fight them with,"
said Miss Baybax.
Hollows are suddenly a rather endangered species.
I think I can handle it, I said. I know the hollow they took pretty well, too, which could help. Miss Baybax nodded seriously.
That is just what I was hoping you'd say. As soon as we get this damned panopticon contraption operational again, said Miss Blackbird, expect a call to action.
Miss Blackbird showed me out, her hand gripping my arm again, a gesture that now struck me as more for her comfort than mine. I had become a lifeline of hope, and she was reassuring herself of my realness. I'd left my friends down in the Panlupticon's guts, and I wondered where they were. I asked Miss Blackbird, and she waved vaguely at the end of the entrance hall she was hurrying me down, and its big door flanked by two burly guards.
Elders, help me, she muttered. They're all here.
Outside the building, the crowd had grown huge. Peculiars from around the acre had converged on the Panlupticon, looking for answers. The moment Miss Blackbird and I came out the front door, they began shouting. In the very front of the scrum were Farish Abuelo and another reporter. The big eye in the middle of Farish's forehead stared fiercely at the one in the center of Miss Blackbird's, and the other reporter was sketching a picture of Miss Blackbird and me so quickly that his hand was just a blur.
Madam, can you tell us how exactly the whites managed to escape? Farish shouted.
We're still conducting our investigation, Miss Blackbird said.
The other reporter bounced forward.
Is the prison you built secure? Could it happen again?
Very secure, and we're doubling our guards and reinforcing the battlements around it as we speak. Be assured, the rest of the whites aren't going anywhere.
Do you think they had help? Said Farish.
Help?
She gave him a withering glare. He tried another.
What's Jacob Portman got to do with all this?
I felt my face go hot.
No comment!
Miss Blackbird shouted.
Do you think you've allowed yourselves to be too distracted by the situation in America to properly manage things here?
Miss Blackbird's mouth dropped open, so shocked was she by the audacity of the question. Sharon loomed behind us. I could feel his coldness at my back. And then he thundered in his overwhelming basso voice,
Quiet!
The crowd noise faded to a murmur.
The Imbrins will address the crisis very soon. You'll be given all the facts. But right now we must clear this area.
The power of his voice alone might have been enough to achieve it, but the appearance of his gallows-rigging cousins from around the side of the building sealed the deal, and the crowd began to disperse.
Keep away from those vultures,
Miss Blackbird said, and she gave my arm a sympathetic squeeze before disappearing back inside the building. I saw Noor waving to me from the thinning crowd. She was riding on Bronwyn's shoulders. I pushed toward them and found Emma and Enoch, too, and Horace, who had apparently ventured across the acre on his own to join us.
So, what did old Bonnie Blackbird want?
Enoch asked.
The nerve of her asking you to fetch another hologast, Emma fumed, as if you were just some expendable errand boy.
I saw Farish eyeing me with interest.
Jacob, a few questions.
Let's talk somewhere else, I muttered to my friends, steering them away. The last thing I needed was to end up in the muckraker.
You never mentioned you were famous, Noor said, eyeing me playfully.
Local celebrity, Emma said proudly.
Flavor of the week,
Enoch grumbled. Bronwyn smirked.
That's what you said last week.
We walked down Oozing Street, past the slaughterhouse turned B&B and a pub called The Shrunken Head, and when it seemed like we'd put enough distance between us and prying ears, I told them what the Imbrins had asked of me.
Are you going to do it? Asked Horace.
Of course, I said. If the whites are up to something, we need to find out what it is.
Knowing them, they've been up to whatever it is for quite a while,
said Emma. Now they're just putting the wheels in motion.
They wanted to break out of jail just like all prisoners do, Enoch said. That doesn't mean they have some evil agenda.
The Whites always have an evil agenda, Millard said. He had disrobed at some point, and I'd almost forgotten he was there. Enoch dismissed Millard with an eh, then looked at Noor and said,
What about her?
What do you mean? I said. Noor shot him a look. Yeah, what do you mean?
I thought you were helping her, Portman.
I am, I said.
How are you going to do that while you're chasing after escaped Whites?
I'll do both. I can handle myself, Noor cut in. I'll be fine.
Oh, yeah? Said Enoch. What would you do if a grim bear attacked you?
A what? He winked at me.
Exactly.
Noor's expression turned to stone.
A grim bear would never attack a peculiar child like us, said Bronwyn. They only go after...
Thank you, Bronwyn, we know, I said. And shut up, Enoch. Enoch had embarrassed her, and I worried I'd only made it worse.
So do you think the Whites might actually have had inside help? Said Millard, oblivious as usual to the emotional dynamics of the conversation.
They must have, said Bronwyn. That prison is solid as a mountain. I should know. I helped build it with my own hands.
The only way they could have made that hole in the wall and gotten their hands on an explosive is if someone in Devil's Acre helped them.
But who?
Are you kidding? Said Emma. The list of suspicious characters around here is longer than my arm. Could have been ex-ditch pirates, mercenaries, ambrosia addicts.
I thought most of them got run out of town, Enoch said.
Most of them, Emma replied. I think some of them are covering up their past and are just pretending to be on the Imbrin side.
Some peculiars aren't even pretending anymore, said Millard.
Look at this.
He had stopped in front of a cart selling newspapers. Most were from the present, brought in weekly from outside the loop to keep us, sort of, up to date on the goings-on of the larger world. But there were a couple of peculiar newspapers, too. One was The Muckraker, and its headline read, Imbrin's Bungle Loop Security, Whites Escape. I snatched a copy from the rack.
How did they already print this? I marveled. It just happened.
Special edition, said the boy behind the cart.
An old acquaintance of mine works for the Muckraker, Horace said mysteriously. Once in a while he gets advance word of things.
I kept reading. A smaller opinion article below the fold was titled, Are Imbrins Too Focused on America's Problems to Solve Ours? I was too angry to read it.
Look at this, said Emma, drawing my attention to a billboard wall where the escaped Whites' mugshots had just been posted.
Wanted for murder was emblazoned across the top, and a long list of their crimes and aliases trailed below.
Don't they look a rough crowd, said Horace. Wouldn't want to meet them in a dark alley at night.
They don't scare me, said Enoch.
These two are mild as milk, like bank tellers.
I saw the Whites he was talking about. One had thin, round glasses and a long nose. The other looked downright professorial. The other two looked like brawlers, especially the one on top, who had a thick nose, wiry hair, and was the only one with pupils, fake though they were. They were aimed upward and to the left, which gave the man an unsettling air of total ease, as if he were daydreaming about his next vacation, or how he was going to strangle the photographer in the night. The name printed below his mugshot, P. Murnau. There was an announcement made over a loudspeaker that things were to go on as usual, and all peculiars would be expected to report to their jobs or classes. Of course, we would be doing no such thing. We had much bigger fish to fry.
I think we can see Miss Avocet today,
Horace said to Nor. But I'll need to make an appointment. She's awfully busy. I might be able to get us in this afternoon if I beg.
Please do beg, Horace, said Bronwyn.
And if that doesn't work, threaten, said Millard. If the rest of you could lend your hands and your eyes to me, it would help a great deal. I've got a few hundred loop maps to comb through in the peculiar archives, and at this stage it's all hands on deck.
Of course, Emma said. I'm all yours, said Bronwyn. I'll go fetch Olive and Claire, too. I'm sure they'll want to help.
We're in, obviously, I said, trading a nod with Nor. Emma narrowed her eyes at me. She nearly wagged a finger when she said,
Unless, of course, the Imbrins need you. Right, Jacob?
Right, I said, trying to keep my voice mild. Emma had been acting weird ever since Nor arrived, but I decided to let it go. Luckily, Nor didn't seem to notice. Either that, or she didn't much care. She turned toward Millard's half-clothed ghost and said, Do you have any specific ideas, or are we just searching blindly?
Not exactly blind, Millard replied. I snuck out late last night and had a midnight chat with a friend. You remember Perplexus Anomalous?
You bothered him at midnight? Enoch snorted.
People as old as Perplexus hardly sleep, said Millard. And ever since we saved him from aging forward, he's been very friendly toward me.
Millard sounded proud of himself, and I could see why. He was making friends with one of his heroes.
Anyhow, I told him about our puzzle and the map fragment, and the ex-hologast's mumbled clues, and Perplexus pointed out that if V's loop is in America, and it seems quite likely that it is, and if it is beset with large windstorms, as the phrases in the big wind, in the heart of the storm would seem to imply, then it would make the most sense to search the Midwestern United States. There's a rather wide strip down the center of the country that's known colloquially as Tornado Alley.
Of course, Nor said, nodding. Nebraska, Oklahoma, Kansas, the Wizard of Oz states.
What about you?
Bronwyn said, tossing Enoch a look. He frowned.
I'd been imagining what a morning of relaxation and leisure might look like, if I'm being honest, though I suppose that ship has sailed.
How would you relax around here anyway? I said.
Oh, the acre has its pleasures. I could always view a hanging, or have a mud bath and fever ditch.
He gestured to the muddy stream beside us. And on that depressing note, our group started to disperse.
Hey, Enoch was joking, right?
Nor whispered to me.
I think so.
And then something wet hit me in the back with a splat.
There he is!
Someone shouted as I spun around and a gob of mud struck me square in the chest.
Go back to where you came from, phony!
It was Itch, the half-fish, half-man, who held a nasty grudge against me. He was standing waist-deep in the creek, lobbing gobs of muck in my direction.
Stop that!
Bronwyn shouted. She looked around for something to toss back at him, but she wasn't fast enough. A lady ditch dweller chose that moment to rise from the mire and throw her own clump of mud in our direction.
Loop freedom for all!
The woman shouted. This one hit both me and Nor, who was standing too close to me. My friends were all yelling at them, and Emma sparked a ball of fire in her hand and was waving it at them menacingly. But there wasn't much we could do other than scurry out of throwing range, which we did. I was dripping with the stuff. Nor less so, but she'd gotten hit too.
What the hell is their problem? Nor said, scraping mud from her shirt.
They're just angry and bitter that none of us have to worry about aging forward anymore,
Bronwyn said.
You two had better wash that stuff off, and good,
said Enoch, wrinkling his nose.
It's toxic.
I could definitely use a shower, I said, looking down at myself. You quite seriously need one, I'm afraid, said Millard. This section of Fever Ditch is infested with flesh-eating microbes.
Flesh-eating what? I said, horrified.
Don't worry, they're slow, Enoch said. It would take them probably a full week to eat you whole.
Okay, yeah, a shower would be good, Nor said, looking a bit freaked out. I caught Bronwyn inching away from us.
You need hot running water and soap, said Enoch, but the only place you'll find that is...
Emma and Enoch looked at each other.
There is one possibility, Emma said, worrying her bottom lip, though it's slightly complex and just a little bit risky.
We don't exactly have a choice, do we? I said, glancing apologetically at Nor. I'm pretty sure we're going to need all of our skin, whatever we do.
Enoch shrugged. Nor looked miserable. And Emma was backing away from us as she shouted directions to a safe house just outside the Devil's Acre Loop in present-day London. It had modern bathrooms, hot water, the works.
We'll be at the mapping department in the ministry's building, Millard said. Meet us there when you're clean. Just make sure you get every bit of that stuff off you.
Yeah, said Enoch, because I, for one, enjoy having skin.
Nor and I went down to the boat dock at Fever Ditch, trying not to think too much about the microscopic bugs slowly devouring our skin, and in exchange for a silver coin that Horace had given me, a grizzled old boatman piloted us down the slow black river in a glorified canoe. Rather than talk in front of a stranger, we were mostly silent, and Nor spent much of the trip holding her nose and gazing up at the crumbling tenements we passed, where washerwomen hung laundry from the windows and raggedy kids shouted down the alleys.
They're normal, I said, part of the loop. Nor seemed fascinated.
You mean they do the same thing every day?
Every second of every day,
the boatman rasped.
I've been here 72 years, and I know it all.
He jerked the tiller, and the boat turned sharply left. A moment later, a boy running across an overhead footbridge tripped and fell into the water a few feet to our right, just where we would have been.
Now he'll call that other muck snipe a pigeon-livered ratbag,
the boatman muttered. The boy surfaced.
You pigeon-livered ratbag!
He shouted at someone up on the footbridge. Nor shook her head.
That's wild.
As we approached the long, dark tunnel that marked the loop exit, Nor started humming. The melody was sweet and simple, like a nursery rhyme, and I could see her shoulders relax as she hummed it. I meant to ask her about it, but then the dark enveloped us. We were gripped by the sudden rush of a loop changeover, and after a few seconds we emerged into a much-changed London. This one comprised of glass-walled buildings and clean streets. The boatman dropped us at the bank without a word, happy to be rid of us. We followed Emma's directions. We made a few turns, crossed a wide shopping street crowded with businesses and buses, made another turn down a residential block, and soon we were there, a simple two-story house on a street of nearly identical houses, all connected. I'd been keeping a keen feel out for hollows because you never knew, but I'd felt no twinges out of the ordinary. We rang the bell. A man I didn't know answered. He wore a black suit and apron just like Ulysses's, another temporal affairs minion. He looked us over for a moment, asked our names, then let us inside. Miraculously, there were two bathrooms. Nothing in my life had ever felt so good. I stood under the hot spray while the mud and grit and flesh-eating microbes ran off me and spiraled down the drain, I hoped. Then I scrubbed my skin until it hurt. I dried myself with a heavy white towel, found a new razor,
and an unopened stick of deodorant in the vanity, and my heart sank a little as I realized we had only our dirty, ditch-stained clothes to change back into. Just then came a knock at the door, and the man who had let us in told me there was a wardrobe of clothes in the next room, and I could choose anything I liked. I wrapped a towel around my waist and went out to explore my options. I found a hunter green button-up shirt that fit well, a pair of dark pants, and some brown lace-up ankle boots, an outfit I hoped would blend into various time periods. I went out into the living room. Nor hadn't emerged yet, so I stood at the window and watched the street for a minute, the mailman pushing his cart from house to house, an old man walking a dog, and I marveled at how such a profoundly mundane world could exist right next door to ours. "Hey," I heard Nor say, and then I casually turned and saw her walk into the room, and for a moment I couldn't believe it was the same person I'd arrived with. She'd put on a simple white Henley shirt and blue jeans, and her hair was brushed and shining, and she was beautiful. We'd been mired in filth and running for our lives for so much of the time we'd been together, I had almost forgotten just how beautiful she was. This took me so by surprise, I realized that I didn't have time to hide my reaction. And now, oh God, I was staring at her. I cleared my throat. You look really nice, I said. She laughed, and I think she was blushing. You do too. There was a moment of silence which probably lasted only 2 or 3 seconds, but felt infinite, and then she said, Well, we should probably be getting back, huh? A sudden clanging filled the house. The minion from Temporal Affairs dashed into the room. What is that? I said.
The doorbell, he replied.
Someone was ringing it like the end of the world was upon us. The minion ran downstairs to answer it, and a short time later, after a thunderous noise of feet pounding up the stairs, Hugh and Emma appeared, out of breath.
You need to come back, Emma said.
We tried to call, but the line was engaged, said Hugh.
What's going on? I said, trading a worried look with Nor. Did you find V's loop? Nor looked hopeful, but Emma was shaking her head.
Not yet, she said. It's Horace. He's with Miss Avocet right now. When he told her what he was after, she met with him right away, and they're waiting for us.
Apparently they found something, Hugh said. Something big. But they wouldn't say what.
We were all tripping over one another to reach the stairs. Emma and Hugh had a boat waiting for us at the dock, and this one had a motor on it. Emma barked at the boatman to drive like his life depended on it, and a minute later, we were flying through the loop entrance so fast my head was spinning. We left a wide brown wake behind us in Fever Ditch, and had to hang on to the sides of the boat to keep from falling out, and when we finally docked in the center of town, I'd never been so happy to touch dry land. Miss Avocet's office was inside the Peculiar Ministries building, formerly St. Barnabas Asylum for Lunatics, Mountebanks, and the Criminally Mischievous. We rushed through its busy lobby with its registration windows and glum-faced bureaucrats, then up a few flights of stairs to a hallway. Someone came rushing out of a door and ran straight into me, and papers went everywhere.
No, no, drat! I had these all in order, he said,
and he'd already dropped to his knees to gather them up when I saw who it was.
Horace, Nor said. It's us!
He looked up sharply, his eyes a bit wild. He had papers poking out from under his arms and up in the brim of his hat like feathers, and between that and his overly formal tuxedo, he looked like a bewildered peacock.
Oh, he said, good, there's so much to tell. Where to start?
We knelt and helped him gather up the papers.
So that text H spoke about, he said, speaking fast. Miss Avocet knew it.
It's called The Apocryphon. And as it turns out, it's a real book. He stuffed a few papers into a leather folder, which was already overflowing, then stuffed a few more into his vest. It's extremely obscure, even in the already obscure canon of peculiar prophecy. But when I asked Miss Avocet about it, she nearly fell out of a chair. She cancelled all her meetings for the rest of the day and convened her best Imbrins in training to work on this. She said she hadn't heard anyone mention the prophecy of the Seven or the Apocryphon in many years, and she'd been dreading the day she would. With all the papers gathered, he stood up and gestured to the door across the hall, which was twice as large as all the doors near it and labeled with a sign that read, E. Avocet, by appointment only. I went to open the door, but it swung inward with a loud creak before I could reach the handle. It was dark and cavernous inside, and it took my eyes a moment to adjust to the gloom. The back wall was all windows, but they were completely covered over with newspapers, so that they filtered only a slight orange glow. The office was lit instead by candles and candelabras, 100 or more, dancing and twinkling everywhere, and in their dim pools of light, I could see nothing but books and girls. Books in spiraling towers, books in laddered shelves to the ceiling, books in piles that tilted at impossible angles but somehow stayed aloft. For every pile, there was a studious young woman in a long dress, 12 in all, poring over pages, writing in notebooks, necks bent at painful angles. These were students of Miss Avocet's Imbrin Academy, from which Miss Peregrine herself had graduated a very long time ago. They were so absorbed in their work, they didn't even glance up at us as we passed. We snaked around the piles until we reached an old, familiar face, Miss Avocet, seated at a desk that was drowning in papers.
Ah, you're finally here, she said. Come in, young ones. Fanny, make room.
What I'd taken for a rug let out a rumbling growl, and a big brown grim bear lumbered up from the floor and slouched off into the corner.
Don't be frightened, dear heart, Miss Avocet said to Nor. He's tame as an emu raff, but he acts like he owns the place.
I'm fine, thanks, Nor said, though the shock hadn't quite disappeared from her face. Miss Avocet squinted.
I hope you don't mind the light. Whale oil smokes too much, and gas lamps bother my eyes.
Then she invited us to sit on the long velvet couch facing her desk. She pushed a pair of tiny wire spectacles up her nose and leaned forward on her elbows. The welcoming smile she'd greeted us with vanished, and her eyes gleamed with purpose despite their rheumy cataracts.
I won't waste time, as I've got little to waste, she said, her voice shaking slightly. The Apocryphon, as you might have surmised by its name, is regarded a bit dubiously by scholars of peculiar prophecy, when it is regarded at all. It is little known, not even a proper book. It was never written, merely written down. Its full title is The Apocryphon of Robert Le Bourge, Revelator of Avignon, but I've heard it shortened to The Apocryphon of Bob the Revelator.
What's a revelator? Nor asked.
It's a fancy word for prophet, said Horace.
Le Bourge was anything but fancy, said Miss Avocet. Old Bob was an uneducated farmhand who spoke mainly in babbling incoherencies, and most who knew him thought he was possessed, an idiot, or some combination of the two. But sometimes this man who could hardly speak would tremble as if electrified, and hold forth in fully formed quatrains of sonorous, seemingly extemporaneous rhyming verse. That was amazing enough, but when people noticed that his verses sounded like predictions, and some of those predictions came to pass, he became famous, and people began writing down the things he said.
They must have thought he was some kind of angel, said Nor.
Devil, more like, said Miss Avocet. He was plunged into boiling oil for the crime of divination, but suffered nothing from it. Another time he was hanged, but only pretended to be dead, then escaped from the embalmer's room. He was peculiar, of course, and one of the more fascinating figures from our history.
She turned her head slightly and said to the room,
Someone could write an excellent term paper on him if one were so inclined.
Then she returned her eyes to us.
The Apocryphon of Bob is a collection of his pronouncements, recorded by whomever happened to be present at the time.
What about the Prophecy of the Seven? I asked.
The Prophecy of the Seven appears only in a few translations of the text. It seems that speakers of a number of different languages were present at its utterance, and each recorded their own account in their own tongue. There is some disagreement amongst them, and the most widely known version of it is at best an educated guess at what Bob actually said, a necessarily compromised melding of them all, translated into English. Fortunately, my star pupil speaks many of those languages, and has been hard at work untangling the web.
An elegant young woman stepped forward, hands clasped around a notebook. She had wing-like hair, dark skin, and eyes that radiated intelligence.
This is Francesca, said Miss Avocet, and if she passes my examinations at the end of this term, which I expect she will, she'll become Miss Bitten, our newest Imbrin.
Miss Avocet was beaming with pride. Francesca smiled gently.
Take it away, lass.
Francesca opened a notebook.
The Prophecy of the Seven was written some 400 years ago, she began, but it begins with several references to our own time period. Listen. And now a word, an uncouth rhyme, of what shall be in future time, when folk shall fly as birds do now, and give away the horse and plough, and round the world their thoughts will fly, quick as the twinkling of an eye, when creatures made of shadow creep to stalk our children in their sleep, and Imbrins cease their flocks to tend.
She stopped and looked at us over her glasses.
You get the idea, she flipped ahead a few pages. After some more of this, it says, When the prisons are blown to dust and chaos reigns, and the betrayers summon their king, the old ones from their sleep are torn, an age of strife will soon be born.
A chill traveled through the room, and for a moment even the candles seemed to shiver. Francesca looked up from her notes.
And then it goes on to describe a war. Every land on earth will sink and reek and wallow in stench and stink of rotted trunks of beast and man and vegetation crisped on land. Thank you, Francesca, Miss Avocet said. I think we get the picture.
She turned to face my friends and me.
As you can see, old Bob had a flair for drama.
Does that mean the Imbrins will fail?
Emma asked.
The piece won't hold.
The big room went suddenly silent as all the Imbrins in training stopped turning pages and looked up from their books.
Absolutely not,
Miss Avocet said acidly.
Here, let me see that.
Francesca turned over the book and Miss Avocet flipped through the pages, flustered.
This bit of translation is rather vague. It doesn't necessarily describe a war between peculiar clans, for instance. You have to let me check your work, Franny.
Of course, ma'am.
Francesca nodded humbly.
Perhaps I made a mistake in the transliterations between Latin, Hungarian, and old peculiar.
Yes, that must have been it.
I have faith in the Imbrins,
Francesca felt compelled to say. Miss Avocet patted her hand.
I know you do, dear.
But it means something terrible will happen, said Hugh. with lots of dying.
What about the seven? Nor said. I nodded. Yeah, aren't they supposed to stop this from happening? Emancipate peculiardom?
But emancipate implies something terrible does happen, said Emma. And the seven help later. That bit's near the end, said Miss Avocet. Oh, you read it. Your eyes are still young.
She handed the book back to Francesca.
Emancipate is another of those fuzzy words, said Francesca, though it's clear that the seven are crucially important. The only line that all the translations agree on is this: to end the strife of war, seven may seal the door.
The door to what? Nor said. Francesca wrinkled her nose.
Don't know.
I don't mean to make this about me, Nor said. But does it mention me?
Yes, near the end,
said Miss Avocet, and she turned a strange warm smile at Nor, as if she'd been looking forward to this.
It foretells the births of the seven. Well, it begins to, but the text we have does not appear to be complete.
Then how do you know I'm one of them? Said Nor. Did Bob include my social security number, or...
It's incomplete, but for one entry, Francesca said. It says that one of them shall be a babe who suckles the light.
I felt a tingle go down my spine. Nor looked skeptical.
A babe? She said. Like a baby?
Now Emma was frowning too.
Babies don't have peculiar abilities.
Miss Avocet nodded lightly.
As an almost ironclad rule, they do not. It is exceedingly, exceedingly rare. But it can happen.
I only started being able to do this a few months ago, Nor said, clawing a bit of light from the air. So this can't mean me.
Ah,
Miss Avocet nodded heavily.
Now I must tell you a story. And I think you should sit down while I tell it, she said to Nor.
I am sitting. Miss Avocet pushed up her glasses and squinted at her.
Good.
She tented her fingers beneath her chin, took a brief, dramatic pause, and then began.
15 years ago, a baby was delivered to us. An infant who was clawing out the light from its nursery and swallowing it.
Nor stared at Miss Avocet, completely still.
I think that baby was you.
Miss Avocet leaned forward.
Tell me, dear. Do you happen to have a little moon-shaped birthmark behind your right ear?
Nor took a beat and a long breath, and then reached up her hand to brush aside the hair that was covering her ear. There behind it was just the birthmark Miss Avocet had described. Nor's hand began to tremble, and she let her hair fall back into place. I felt my chest tighten.
It was me,
Nor said quietly, her eyebrows knitted together.
Yes, it's you.
Miss Avocet smiled.
I was wondering when I might see you again. Oh, my,
Horace whispered, his hands clutched to his chest. But Nor was shaking her head.
Who brought me here? Where were my parents? An Imbrin from Bombay brought you to us. She said you weren't safe there, that your parents had been killed and you are being hunted.
By who?
Hologast, my dear. A particularly vicious strain of them that we had not seen here until a few months after your arrival, that is. After several attacks, a decision was made that the safest course for everyone, including yourself, would be to send you on to America, in the hope that crossing an ocean might throw the hollows off your scent.
I still don't understand, Nor said, beginning to sound a bit exasperated. I never manifested any abilities until a few months ago. I didn't grow up able to do this.
Miss Avocet lowered her voice a touch and leaned forward on her desk.
Before you went, we gave you an experimental serum that would dramatically reduce your ability and delay its resurgence until young adulthood. You see, the Hollows can smell us when we use our powers. So we thought that, in addition to hiding you in America, this would keep you safe for years to come.
She smiled warmly.
I'm gratified to see that it did. What a remarkable young woman you've become, Miss Pradesh. I've often wondered about you. I was tempted to inquire after you, but I feared doing so might have tipped the whites off to your location.
Nor stared at the floor, kneading her temples with her thumbs.
But I didn't grow up with an Imbrin, or around other peculiar kids. I've been in foster homes ever since I could remember.
Who did you send her to America with? I asked.
It was one of your grandfather's associates,
said Miss Avocet.
A woman named Veljana.
My mouth fell open. Nor's head snapped up.
What did she look like? Has anyone got a picture of her?
I'm sure we've got one here somewhere,
Miss Avocet said, waving at Francesca. The Imbrins in training leapt to action, and within a minute, the picture of the woman was located.
She's quite a bit younger in this photo than she would have been when she accompanied you,
Miss Avocet said, and as she handed it over, I was able to glance at it. It was V, all right, the same portrait of her that the diviners had shown us at their loop in Georgia. Nor held it up. After a moment, her hand began to shake.
Mama,
she whispered. A chill went through me. Through all of us.
She took care of me until I was 6, Nor said. And then she was killed.
Nor paced back and forth in front of Miss Avocet's desk, turning the picture of V over and over in her hands.
They told me it was a robbery, she said. Mama and I were walking at night when some men attacked us. I fell and hit my head. I still have a scar.
She absently touched the hair above her right ear.
I woke up in a hospital. They told me she'd been killed.
You can be sure it wasn't a robbery,
said Miss Avocet.
And she wasn't killed. What you experienced was an attack by whites, probably accompanied by a Hollowghast. She managed to fight them off, it seems. But when you got hurt, she realized she couldn't keep you safe anymore.
So she gave me up,
Nor said, her voice verging on tears, and let me think she was dead. Miss Avocet stood and came out from behind her desk. She clasped Nor's hands.
She had no choice. She knew you would only be safe amongst normals, and any contact with you would have put your life at risk. My God, that must have been so heartbreaking for her, said Emma.
But someone must have looked in on her now and then, Hugh said. Maybe it couldn't have been V, but...
That gave me an idea. I took Miss Avocet aside and asked her if she had any pictures of my grandfather in her archives. Within a short time, one was located. It was a snapshot of Abe sitting on the porch of a house peering down the sight of a rifle, taken years ago, Miss Avocet explained, during a loop invasion preparedness drill. I showed it to Nor.
He looks a lot younger here, but I think that's Mr. Gandhi.
She looked a bit confused.
Why, did you know him?
My heart skipped a beat. Emma crowded in to look, then gasped.
Abe!
Gandhi had been Abe's alias. That's my grandfather, I said, and now Hugh and Horace were jostling to see the picture too.
He used to check in on me, Nor said. I thought he worked for the foster agency.
Abe was checking up on you, Emma said, but not for the foster agency.
You've been part of our family all along, dear, Miss Abbasett said to Noor. You just didn't know it.
And she stood up and wrapped Noor in her frail arms. After the Imbrin let her go, Nora took a moment to collect herself, wiping a tear from her cheek. You okay? I asked her. This is a lot to process. She nodded quickly and looked up, her eyes full of quiet determination.
She's alive, she said, and I'm going to find her.
Ahem.
I spun around at the sound. Discovering nothing, I tossed a questioning look at my friends, who seemed equally startled. We'd all heard someone clear their throat loudly, but when we turned to look, there didn't seem to be anyone there.
Millard? Said Emma, realization dawning. When did you get here? More to the point, Miss Avocet said sharply. How did you get here?
I've been here nearly the whole time, he said. I came in a bit late, didn't want to interrupt.
We have strict rules about invisibles sneaking around in the nude, Mr. Nullings.
Yes, ma'am, my humblest apologies.
Millard seemed to be walking toward the little knot of us standing beside Miss Avocet's desk.
I'm not sure whether Horace told you, but we're trying to make sense of not just this prophecy, but of a map too. One that we believe leads to a loop where V currently resides.
Miss Avocet raised an eyebrow at Horace.
No, she said slowly. Horace had not mentioned that.
There was hardly time, ma'am, Horace said. And besides, maps are Millard's expertise.
Miss Avocet merely sighed.
So, what's the news?
Noor asked Millard, her face brightening.
Did you find something?
Not yet. Olive and Claire are still downstairs searching for any Midwest geographies that resemble your map fragment, but it's a bit of a needle in a haystack situation. However, I think this fascinating new revelation could help us.
He took a heavy step toward Noor.
You lived with V until you were 6, yes?
5 and a half,
Noor said, and then she was nodding, already seeming to know what he was about to ask.
You want to know if I remember anything about where we lived?
Yes. If nothing else, it would give us an idea of our general stomping grounds.
Why would V hide in the same area she was attacked? I asked.
If she's in some secret loop, it could be very close indeed. Proximity doesn't really matter so long as the loop entrance is skillfully hidden. I just need some telling concrete detail. The names of any towns where you lived would be ideal.
Noor's brow scrunched. She shook her head.
I can't remember any. We moved around a lot, lived in a lot of different places, never stayed anywhere for long.
Surely you remember something, Millard said, a bit desperate. Even the smallest fragment of a memory could prove essential.
Noor bit her lip, lost in thought.
Well, we lived in a city for a while, in a little apartment. I remember the radiator pinging all night long and these big vents in the street that let out steam. And we used to take the bus, this old bus with green plastic seats that smelled like lemon oil.
Oh, that sounds like it might be something,
Bronwyn said, sitting up. Millard sighed a long-suffering sigh.
The map fragment is not urban, he said. So no, those memories are not terribly useful. Was there someplace else?
Lots of places, Noor said. But none for very long.
She paused, thinking.
Except one, a little town. We used to go back a lot, but what I can remember of it is really hazy.
She let out a sharp, frustrated breath.
Weirdly hazy. Almost like...
Someone took your memories?
Francesca. I hadn't realized she'd been listening. Noor looked at her strangely.
I didn't even realize that was possible.
Francesca and Miss Avocet locked eyes.
Ma'am,
said Francesca.
Do you think Miss Pradesh could have been memory wiped?
Miss Avocet was nodding, kneading her hands together.
If she has other memories from that time, it's possible someone might have done only a partial wipe on her, to remove a specific batch of memories.
Wait, what? Said Noor, her eyes getting wider. You guys are serious about this?
Memory wipes are quite common, said Bronwyn.
On normals,
Hugh said in an undertone. Noor was not looking reassured. Miss Avocet laid a steadying hand on Noor's arm.
It sounds as if it was only a small one, to keep you safe from harm, dear. If V worried for your safety, she might also have worried that she would one day try to return to where you once lived, out of nostalgia, or some pull for a place that felt like home.
Noor studied her shoes. She said nothing, but her heartbreak was clear.
Imagine someone doing that to their own child, Emma said, her voice solemn. I had to do it to my own parents, I said with a heavy sigh. It wasn't an easy choice.
Noor was shaking her head.
Maybe V wasn't trying to keep me safe at all, she said quietly. Maybe she just didn't want me.
Stuff and nonsense, Miss Avocet cried, standing upright so quickly she pinched a muscle in her back. She grabbed at the edge of her desk for support and, wincing, slowly eased herself back down.
Oh dear. Francesca, I may have snipped a bit of muscle again. Would you be a dear and fetch me my oils?
At once, ma'am, Francesca said and hurried off.
Another loud throat clearing. Millard.
Apologies, Noor, but I'm afraid we don't have time for you to feel sorry for yourself, he said.
I nearly shouted at him for being so unkind, but he cut me off.
It's abundantly clear, he was saying, that this V woman cared a great deal about you. Otherwise, she might have just handed you over to the whites. So might we please refocus the conversation?
Noor scowled, but somehow she seemed a bit mollified. Soon her scowl eased into steely resolve.
Very good,
Miss Avocet said, still positioned awkwardly in her desk chair.
Miss Pradesh, would you submit yourself to a small procedure?
A procedure? She asked, her eyebrows high.
You see,
Miss Avocet said, still wincing a little,
very occasionally we Imbrans make a mistake.
It clearly pained her to admit it.
And we memory wipe the wrong people, or memory wipe them a bit too much, and it becomes necessary to try to undo a bit of what we did. We have a man on staff, Mr. Reggie Breedlove, whose talent is the retrieval of some of those lost memories. Now, it's not science, this, and because it's been so long since your wipe, I can't guarantee we'll get much in the way of results.
Oh, Noor said, a hopeful edge to her voice. I think it would be worth a try.
Miss Avocet smiled.
That's the spirit.
15 minutes later, Breedlove arrived at Miss Avocet's office. Francesca had administered to the Imbrin the necessary oils for her injured back. Miss Avocet stood straight up, revived, and Breedlove stumbled in like a drunk, or at least like a man who'd just been roused from bed, his suit and tie put on hastily. He was tall and olive-skinned, and he had a wide face and even wider eyes that never seemed to blink. Francesca led him toward us. He continued to stumble over a pile of books, catching himself just before falling.
He looks a bit off balance, Emma said doubtfully. Have a little faith in your elders, snapped Miss Avocet.
Breedlove went to work right away. Noor, having been assured by Miss Avocet that this wouldn't hurt a bit and wouldn't erase any more of her memories, was seated in a straight-backed chair in front of the fireplace. He stood behind Noor like a hairdresser might.
Stare into the flames, he instructed her. Don't think about anything.
I'll do my best,
Breedlove held his big palms out on either side of Nora's head. He closed his eyes. A fine, thin stream of smoke began to waft out of his nostrils. Nora's eyes searched the fire, as if she were seeing something in the flames. Her hair, the strands that weren't gathered in a ponytail, rose and danced in the air. I leaned toward her. "Are you okay?" I whispered.
"Please don't speak,"
Breedlove said. I was about to argue, then thought better of it. Millard paced the rug nervously. Emma and Bronwyn sat, each hugging herself on the couch, unintentionally mirroring the other. Miss Avocet was completely still, her eyes shining. I stood close to Noor, studying her face for any reaction, ready to put a stop to this if it seemed to be hurting her. 30 seconds ticked by. "What are you doing?" I asked Breedlove. Francesca held up a hand to me, but this time Breedlove allowed the interruption.
"Searching for blank spots,"
he explained. I was about to ask a follow-up question when he suddenly stiffened.
"Yes, here," he said. "This section is full of little holes."
His voluminous eyebrows shot up.
"And one large one."
"Anything you can restore?" Miss Avocet asked.
"Perhaps."
His hands drew closer to Nora's temples. The stream of smoke from his nose thickened, and his own hair began to stand up.
"Perhaps a few things."
And then Nora started speaking, slowly, as if half in a trance.
"I remember playing in a river, a deep, wide river. It had a really long name."
Miss Avocet cut her eyes toward Francesca.
"Are you writing this down?"
Francesca held up her pad. So did two other Imbrins in training standing behind her. Nora said,
"There was a big tree in the yard. An elm, Mama said. It had a swing. I fell once and twisted my ankle. She wouldn't let me go on it for a month after that. And I was so upset."
"What else?"
Breedlove asked her, his voice growing melodic. The smoke from his nostrils was fast becoming a problem, rising in dense tendrils toward the rafters above us. Nor didn't seem to mind.
"Apples," she said. "Wild apples from the woods we used to pick in the fall. They were so sweet and delicious, and the juice would run down my arms. But then..."
She was quiet for a moment, and so was the room but for the sound of pens scribbling on paper. Then she went on.
"Itchy. So itchy all over."
She began to scratch her arms and her chest, as if feeling it again.
"I got these little red bumps from playing in a briar patch. They looked like triangles," she said. "After that, we didn't play in the woods much. Mama said they were dangerous. There were men with guns there, men in bright orange jackets. We saw them once in the parking lot of the big store, and they had a big dead animal strapped to the roof of their truck. It was so sad. When I saw it, I cried."
"What was the name of the store?" I said, just above a whisper. Breedlove glowered at me. Nora's face tightened. Her eyes wandered the